You're listening to the Asymptote Podcast, and in this episode we're bringing you more tales of the uncanny with stories by Franz Kafka, Yoko Ogawa, Mansoura S. Eldin, and Dean Pashal. But first, I want to ask you this question. Why is it that we're so obsessed with the supernatural? I don't mean human beings in general. That's a given since the beginning of time. What I mean is human beings right now. We live in an era that values rationality and factuality. The post-Enlightenment world is governed by science, capital, technology, statistics, whereas spirituality and religion play way smaller roles than in previous generations. Or at least, that's what it looks like on the surface. But popular culture tells a different story. If the stuff we watch on TV is anything to go by, it seems like we're just as infatuated as ever with ghosts and vampires and supernatural gremlins of all kinds. Pop culture is riddled with the uncanny. It's just that nowadays, instead of using Freud's term, Das Unheimliche, or the uncanny, we usually use a different word to describe it.
Freud complains that other European languages don't really have an equivalent word. But it struck me that contemporary English usage does have such a word, which is creepiness.
That's Adam Kotzko, who's a professor of humanities at Scheimer College, and recently published a fascinating book about creepiness called, well, Creepiness.
Some of the topics that Freud discusses with the uncanny, his main focus is on horror stories, ghost stories, that kind of thing. Tales of the supernatural. And if you look up creepiness or creepy on Amazon right now, the majority of results you're going to find are in that vein. But he also talks about a certain off-puttingness, people who just make you feel weird or uncomfortable, and all of these qualities that overlap. And it just struck me, finally, we've developed an adequate translation, which is creepy.
Adam says the meaning of the word creepy has developed and mutated over the centuries from something that happens outside of us to something that happens inside of us. Asymptote editor Sally Decker met with him and asked some more about the history of the word.
It developed out of an analogy with the way insects move. They creep around, and insects are obviously unwanted. You know, usually they're invading a place that you don't want them to be, and that it kind of took off from there. I believe it was Dickens who coined the idea of the creeps for goosebumps. Something like this, hence the association between creepiness and horror. One especially interesting element is that a creep was specifically a thief who snuck into, who was in brothels and would steal the John's money while they were engaged otherwise. And I thought that was especially funny because Don Draper, at least in certain moments, is a pretty creepy character.
That is Don Draper from the TV show Mad Men.
And at one point he relates that he used to steal money from the clients at the brothel that he grew up in. And this was in just the period of the show when I thought he was at his most creepy, and I thought this is an uncanny correspondence.
Definitely. Yeah.
Throughout his book, Adam pulls up tons of examples of creepiness from popular shows, starting with older sitcoms like Family Matters and Leave It to Beaver and Happy Days that feature a creepy neighbor character whose comedy comes from their lingering intrusiveness. And the strange thing is that in more recent TV dramas like Mad Men, Breaking Bad, House of Cards, the creepy characters have snuck out of the sidelines and become the main protagonists, these odd, unnerving anti-heroes who we watch with mingled repulsion and fascination. Another great example Adam gives is from the classic Burger King adverts a few years ago. Those ones where the guy dressed as the king sneaks into people's bedrooms and lurks there watching them while they sleep. Wake up with the king. Remember those?
Yeah, I think the Burger King mascot is still the best possible example. It's the one example when I was asking people about what they thought of creepiness that everybody agreed, yes, absolutely, that guy is creepy.
Those commercials make us cringe and laugh uncomfortably, because there's nothing quite as creepy as the sensation of being watched. I'd say that's one of the more universal forms of the uncanny across the board. Pretty much every horror movie has those chilling camera angles that peer in on the characters through doors and around corners as if there's something hiding behind the lens, watching.
There's an invasiveness, obviously, to being watched. But I think there's also the fact that you're not using eyesight in the regular way. Like, when you're really staring at somebody, you're drawing attention to the fact that you're looking at them. You want them to be looking at you, looking at them, and you're kind of forcing this mutual encounter on somebody involuntarily. I think that Freud often is puzzled about whether voyeurism or exhibitionism is more primary or more fundamental, and the other one would be just a version of it. But I think they're both clearly mixed up together, that really staring somebody down in a creepy way is a kind of exhibitionist way to look at somebody. It's really, it's strange. It's creepy. Yeah.
Yeah. We have all that feeling of like, feeling the eyes.
Right. And we do seem to have almost a sixth sense.
Exactly.
But I think a new frontier of creepiness in the contemporary world comes from when we're being watched by no one. There was a widely publicized incident where the algorithms for Target detected a woman's pregnancy before she knew that she was pregnant, just based on the pattern of the things that she was buying. And this is creepy, but there's no agent. It's just a computer program that figured it out. And, you know, in this age of mass surveillance and things like that, too, there's something creepy about personalized ads. There's something creepy about thinking that the NSA is just stockpiling every phone call you've ever made. And it's as though virtual creeps are arising out of the technological capacities, you know.
Oh, no. Wow. That's a scary thought.
Yeah.
So on that disturbing note, let's jump back into our audio anthology of creepy stories, starting with an excerpt that's all about that exact feeling, the sensation of being watched by someone or something. Welcome to part two of The Uncanny Listener, Stories from the Shadows.
Uncanny
effects. Doubt as to whether an apparently animate object is alive, or conversely, whether a lifeless object might not, perhaps, be animate.
From Mariah by Dean Paschal.
He was still facing the sofa. He had already noticed that the two sofas were not quite identical. The one the doll was on was slightly longer and had darker, somewhat different-looking woodwork. He was beginning to make other comparisons, but at that moment, the doll began to turn. She began to turn toward him, slowly, as he watched, though not so slowly as to be unlifelike. It was as though she had been interrupted in the midst of a daydream. Her brilliant hazel eyes were not fixed, not what they call doll-like. They moved independently of her head, and slightly in advance of it, giving an effect the realism of which was uncanny. Her hazel-colored eyes were crystalline, maybe literally. There was no movement of her mouth, which, like her face, was ceramic, or ivory, or alabaster, and was doll-like. Though the lips were full, and there was a feeling and even a glimpse of natural teeth. She moved her elbow and left hand from the armrest and crossed both hands, politely, in her lap. She was wearing long white gloves, which, had her jacket been removed, would have proved to extend past her elbows. She moved her right hand and tugged on the fabric of her left glove as though to straighten it or exercise some ghost of disorder. Then she looked at the boy again, directly at him, through him.
commingling of the familiar and unfamiliar, something familiar arising in an unfamiliar context, or its opposite, something unfamiliar arising unexpectedly in a familiar context.
From Old Mrs. J by Yoko Ogawa, as translated by Stephen Snyder.
Look at this!
What is it?
A carrot.
But what a strange shape. It was indeed odd, a carrot in the shape of a hand. It was plump, like a baby's hand, and perfectly formed, five fingers with a thick thumb and a longer finger in the middle.
I'd like you to have it.
Are you sure? Something this rare?
Of course! I've already found three of them. This one's for you. But don't mention it to anyone. Some people might be jealous.
I could feel her moist breath.
Oh, is that potato salad? Then my timing is perfect. A carrot is just the thing.
I sensed the lingering warmth of the sun as I washed the flesh of the carrot. Scrubbing it turned it bright red. I had no idea where to insert the knife, but I decided it would be best to begin by cutting off the five fingers. One by one, they rolled across the cutting board. That evening, my potato salad had bits of the pinky and index finger.
The uncanny is something that remains unsolvable. In the best uncanny literature, the character and reader cannot intellectually or logically solve the uncertainty, and therefore cannot dissipate the mystery and the fear.
From The Stoker by Franz Kafka, as translated by Michael Hoffman.
As the 17-year-old Carl Rossmann, who had been sent to America by his unfortunate parents because a maid had seduced him and had a child by him, sailed slowly into New York Harbor, he suddenly saw the Statue of Liberty, which had already been in view for some time, as though in an intenser sunlight. The sword in her hand seemed only just to have been raised aloft, and the unchained winds blew about her form. "So high," he said to himself, and, quite forgetting to disembark, he found himself gradually pushed up against the railing by the massing throng of porters. A young man with whom he had struck up a slight acquaintance during the crossing said to him in passing, "Well, don't you want to get off yet?" "I'm all ready," said Carl, laughing to him, and in his exuberance and because he was a strong lad, he raised his suitcase onto his shoulder. But as he watched his acquaintance disappearing along with the others, swinging a cane, he realized that he had left his umbrella down in the ship. So he hurriedly asked his acquaintance, who seemed less than overjoyed about it, to be so good as to wait by his suitcase for a moment, took a quick look around for a subsequent orientation, and hurried off. Below deck, he found to his annoyance that a passage that would have considerably shortened the way for him was for the first time barred, probably something to do with the fact that all the passengers were disembarking. And so he was forced instead to make his way through numerous little rooms, along continually curving passages and down tiny flights of stairs, one after the other, and then through an empty room with an abandoned desk in it, until, eventually, only ever having gone this way once or twice previously, and then in the company of others, he found that he was totally and utterly lost. Not knowing what to do, not seeing anyone, and hearing only the scraping of thousands of human feet overhead and the last, faraway wheezings of the engine, which had already been turned off, He began without thinking to knock at the little door to which he had come on his wanderings.
"It's open,"
came a voice from within.
Uncanny effects are produced when the distinction between imagination and reality is erased.
From Gothic Night by Mansoura S. Eldin, as translated by William L. Tamami.
His departure came without explanation. His destination was remote, he said, uttering a series of ominous sounds, the name of a city I had never heard of before. His leaving seemed a matter of fate. In an instant, I could see the city he set out for, with its ashen streets. There are no colors, save for the gray that cloaks much of the place, alongside surreptitious strokes of black and white. Throngs of people walk slowly in the faded streets, wearing grim expressions and staring at a still point ahead. A leaden silence bears down on everything. There he walks, lost in thought, and I, outside the scene, peer at him worriedly, sensing the arrival of a giant with a black coat, sullen face and heavy footsteps. Suddenly chaos reigns. People run in every direction, trying to escape. In the next letter, my friend appeared to have forgotten about his last one, repeating everything he had already said with minor adjustments before continuing the story. The giant with the snuffed-out eyes retreated to his cabin in the woods for a long time, during which he did not utter a single word, instead listening to the sighing of the trees, the twittering of the birds, and the roar of the wind when it blew. When he tired of his solitude and his silence, he took to the streets with heavy footsteps that shook the ground beneath, leaning on his ebony cane, sheltering behind his blind and sullen stare, and armed with his experience in listening to nothingness. His eyes shift over the faces ahead until they fall on one that has the power to restore his vision. He points his finger, and its owner vanishes from existence. The giant tries to gather in all the details of the new world around him before he is plunged into darkness once again, but to no avail. He returns, despondent, to his cabin and his waiting. The city with its Gothic soul takes root in my mind. Its identical streets and imposing squares inhabit me. I dream about the gargoyles on its buildings' facades and awaken feeling like someone who has roamed its paths. I get up at dawn, weighed down by what I've seen. The giant moves in my mind, his expression transformed once again from sullenness to seduction, as though inviting me to follow him. Sometime later, he went back to writing about the city. Long letters that contain nothing personal, no information about him, no questions about me, just extensive passages about this city that bears no resemblance to the cities I know, written in ornate script with small, carefully drawn characters and an exaggerated attention to style. He wrote, "They called it the City of Eternal Sun. Its sun set only after the last inhabitant slept and rose before the first got up. They were all deprived of the night. They were not even aware of its existence. There was no giant then, or faded streets, or people running, just the perennial day and a fierce, barely setting sun. The streets of the city resemble each other so closely they are like infinite replicas of the same street. Its Gothic architecture inspires awe, spired towers and prominent arches, stark, imposing squares, screaming gargoyles with eyes wide open in horror, and gardens more akin to woods pooling out along the city's periphery. I composed a letter for everyone I received from him, not commenting on what he'd written or asking about him, and he, as always, appeared to have not even read mine. Then I began to write without pause, long letters preoccupied with details and penned with care. I send some and neglect to send most, until I stop corresponding with him altogether, intent only on inking hundreds of letters that I stack high here and there throughout my house. I write, ignoring my aching fingers and the pain in my hunched back, blurring the lines between my city and his, between the Gothic architecture with its squares and screaming faces and the perilous precipice with its houses resisting eternal freefall, between his giant with the black coat and blind eyes and the people I see when I open my window, walking cautiously up and down. I emerge from my house, surrounded by plants and thick, tangled trees, and come in shock upon my city with its gray streets and stark squares and the leaden silence bearing down on everything. Closing my eyes, I succumb to the darkness, and the scene opens up silently before me. I see throngs of people moving slowly, staring at a still point ahead. I see him walking, lost in thought, and I hear loud in my ears the thud of heavy footsteps. Could it be coming from me?
That's all from The Uncanny Listener. But before we go, I want to come back to the question I posed at the beginning, which was, if we live in an age of apparent cynicism and rationality, then why is our popular culture increasingly obsessed with paranormal activity? Over the course of making these episodes, I've come up with a totally speculative and grandiose theory about this, so bear with me while I test this out on you. Maybe the reason why we're so hooked on the supernatural is precisely because we're supposed to reject it. Throughout history, almost all societies have had a belief system that embraces transcendental happenings, be it an organized religion or a set of superstitions or a general openness to mysticism. For our ancestors, spirits and ghosts and the inexplicable were an accepted part of life. But then we entered the age of modern science, and it claimed that through systematic study and reason, it could get rid of these grey areas, that it could shine a light on the ghost in the corner and reveal it to be nothing but a white sheet draped on the armchair. So we've gradually packed away the old ideologies and begun to arrange our beliefs around these new, more rigorous, more cynical ones. But there are some things that still don't fit. There are coincidences and inconsistencies and impossibilities that can't be explained, but happen anyway. And where once maybe we wouldn't have been surprised by this, now it sends a chill right through us, because it's the one leftover sign that there are so many things in this world we'll never know. The stories in this episode were excerpted from a wonderful anthology of short fiction called The Uncanny Reader, Stories from the Shadows, published by St. Martin's Griffin and edited by Marjorie Sandor. If you want to hear the rest of these pieces and dig further into the shadowy corners of world literature, get yourself a copy of the book. You can find the link on the Asymptote blog. In this episode, you heard music by Ash Black Buffalo, Garmisch-Partenkirchen, Kai Engel, Rod Hamilton, Roe, and Chris Zabriskie, and performances by Tim Jensen, Sally Decker, Joy Futrell, Elena Passarello, and Tracy Doherty. Thanks so much to all of our performers. Huge thanks to Adam Kotzko for talking with us about creepiness. His book is published by Zero Books and is part of a trilogy with two other studies of strange popular culture obsessions called Awkwardness and Why We Love Sociopaths. Many thanks also to Marjorie Sandor, Eric Gliesk, and everyone else who helped out at Oregon State University, and also to the writers, translators, and publishers who gave us permission to use these stories. We'll have another episode out for you next month with a new host, Daniel Golden. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast for free on iTunes so you don't miss anything. Thanks for listening.